This is Michael Welch for CKUW, and I'm joined by Gerald Amos. Gerald, do you want to talk a little bit, maybe introduce yourself a little bit and say you know, where you're from and what your duties are?
Hey, my name is Gerald Amos. I'm a Chaisla from the community of Kitimat Village on the northwest coast of British Columbia. And I live in a community who is facing the prospects of a port to ship out bitumen from the proposed Enbridge pipeline down through our waters and over to China. And I'm currently, I've been a politician. I was elected chief. I was on council. I've served as a First Nations Summit representative, which represents all of the First Nations communities involved with treaty discussions and a number of other organizations. So I've been pretty active in my lifetime working for the people. And currently I'm a member or one of the partners in what's probably the only First Nations environmental organization in our province, and it's called the Headwaters Initiative. And we're currently working on a number of issues. Wade Davis talked about the headwaters of the Stikine Nass, and we've been somewhat involved in that, and hopefully we'll continue. Mining issues are becoming very prominent in our neck of the woods in northern British Columbia and over into Alaska. And the Enbridge pipeline issue takes up a lot of my time personally, because what we're attempting to do is link our communities together so that the communities themselves can continue to have a conversation on how they can cooperate to work on issues like the Enbridge pipeline. And I've felt for some time, given that the Prime Minister wants to make this a national issue or an issue of national importance, that we need to expand our efforts to bring in voices from communities like Winnipeg and the outlying areas of the province of Manitoba into this conversation as well. Because as people in the panel pointed out, you know, and Wade Davis pointed out, the Enbridge is probably one of the biggest issues confronting us personally, or us in it, particularly in our neck of the woods, but it's a larger issue than that. It's really about the type of decision-making powers that are held by the provincial and federal governments. And we need to be able to influence the outcomes of some of these processes, because right now they're really weighted in favor of the companies.
Could you talk about some of the other challenges that you're, apart from the Enbridge pipeline, that your community is challenging, is experiencing?
Well, over the years, we learned very, very early on that, as I was pointed out in a couple of sessions today, the aluminum company that settled in our area, Alcan at the time, currently Rio Tinto Alcan, changed the way our community was living. We had a pulp mill came in, and really our voices were muted to a large degree by government really not giving us any influence over the way that these negotiations with the companies happen. A lot has changed since then, of course, and we've now got Section 35 in the Constitution and the need to accommodate or to consult and accommodate with our people before any development happens. And that's been an ongoing battle, because you'd think that it would be a simple process to determine what a consultation and accommodation actually means. It's an ongoing battle to put a real face to what actually, in the final analysis, what is accommodation. And as I was saying this evening, to us is more than simply addressing the economic component of these big projects. It's more about having some influence over those processes so that they in fact address the needs of the community. And right now that's not the case.
Could you talk about some of the people living in the community, especially the generations with the kids growing up, they're being subjected to influences that maybe older generations weren't. The values that are being communicated through, I guess, TV or magazines, whatnot, that may run contrary to what you may have grown up with. Are those concerns that maybe have to be addressed as well?
I think those concerns are universal. I don't think that our community is any different than a community in Eastern Canada or a community in Finland or any of those countries. You know, I mean, definitely there's an influence that has some negative components to it, but I'm very optimistic on that front, and simply because, I mean, Wade was talking about his daughter and her commitment. My youngest granddaughter, before I left Kitimat, I was having dried salmon and ulakan oil with her, and she's 3 years old, and she was, I'm telling you, she had ulakan oil dripping down her chin, you know, and she's still connected that way. She eats all of the food that we eat. She loves seaweed, which comes from the Gitgat territory, you know, and that's what we mean, I think, when we talk about our responsibility to those generations coming after us. We need to ensure that my granddaughter has some choices of her own to make, and if the current policies continue to be on the books the way they are, and to have them even watered down anymore, as is being suggested by the Prime Minister, those generations are going to have a really hard, difficult time working with anyone to ensure that they can maintain a lifestyle that involves a little bit of the culture that our ancestral diet that we had at one time.
Of course.
Are you leaving now?
Yeah, I'm going to take off.
I've got to go back to the hotel. So where are you staying?
I'm staying at some place for this conference. I've got to speak tomorrow.
Okay.
Where are you staying?
At the Holiday Inn.
Oh, right.
5 minutes from here.
Yeah. Oh, that's perfect. Yeah. There's a great breakfast place. Stella's across the street.
Yeah, I had.
Yeah, that's. Normally, that's where the university puts me at, but much better than where I am. So I'll see you there tomorrow then?
Yeah, I've got to be here till 10. I'll try to get down there as fast as I can.
Okay,
and
great.
I just go to the front desk and ask for you?
Sure. I'll be in my room.
Okay.
Yeah,
great. Great talk today.
Great, Cheryl. Good to see you. Yep. We'll have to coordinate with some of this stuff.
Yes. Okay, we'll be in touch.
Sorry, excuse me for running.
No problem. Gerald Amos, could you talk about your allies, okay, outside of the Aboriginal community, even perhaps within the Aboriginal community, but I'm thinking especially a lot of the environmental groups and people in the cities, people who with whom you are working to prevent the pipeline. Is there any concern that they don't come from your territory, is that they don't share your ways? Do you see any possible concerns, maybe I don't want to put any words in my, any hazards that you can foresee?
Well, there's always, I mean, we're all human, as they say. You know, we make mistakes. I think the bottom line today is that I think there's an understanding that there is a definite separation between the reality of the First Nations influence and power. I don't like to use the word power, but that's, lack of a better term, the power that comes from this constitutional protection of our rights and title and need to consult and accommodate. That's, I think that, to me, if I were in the environmental community, I'd be, and I think they are cognizant of this fact, and find ways to work with the First Nations community that I think need to be at the forefront of the change that's required to the laws that govern the through the joint review process and the National Energy Board, those there needs to be change there, and without cooperation between the environmental community and our community, I think it's going to be a lot harder. There's power in numbers, and I think that the environmental community brings some expertise to some communities that we might not otherwise have call on. So, you know, in the past there's definitely been some rub there, but I don't think it's as big an issue today as it was, say, 15 years ago.
Because the art of forming that relationship in such a way that your people don't get used, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
They want to stop this pipeline, and they form a kind of a temporary alliance with you, and then they get what they want, and then you don't see that as much of a concern, or?
Well, like I say, I think it has been a concern in the past. I was part of a campaign that started in our community to protect what's now called a protected area, about 800,000 acres of old-growth temperate rainforest that's never been logged commercially. And we began a campaign to stop logging in there that ended up with West Fraser, the company that owned the cutting permits, or the tree farm license, part of their tree farm license. They gave it up voluntarily. And we formed a relationship with a new organization called EcoTrust out of Portland, Oregon. And we had the ability, the wherewithal to frame out our relationship with this organization before we started. So not everybody had the benefit of that, but that's what happened. And that allowed us to take a completely different tact with the Western Canada Wilderness Committee, with Greenpeace, and with others, because I think you're absolutely right. There was a point in time where our communities were roped into a campaign that didn't entail all of the issues that needed to be addressed for the community's interest. Because, like it or not, our communities need to be working at the economic side of things as well as the environmental and the other issues that confront us with these big projects. And logging, as it was at the time. So I think that a lot has changed. Our organizations are better equipped, and it was through this criticism of us being co-opted by big environmental funders out of the United States. The capacity that our organizations like the Coastal First Nations had, which I'm a former chair or president of the Coastal First Nations, and 9 communities represented by that organization. That organization now has far more capacity to work for our communities and to assist the communities in framing out how we actually work with the environmental organization. So, you know, that there's been a lot of progress, I think, on that front.
So moving ahead, we've got what appears to be a conservative government that's determined to move ahead with this in the face of the objections that were stated here tonight. They've got the government and industry have extensive resources at their disposal to shape the opinions of other Canadians. How optimistic are you that your people will manage to prevail in this fight?
Well, I think we're all realistic in our thinking. We know it's going to be a fight. It appears that if this government continues on their path, that it's eventually going to end up in court. But failing that, failing a court challenge and failing any relief through the regulatory process, I've made a commitment to my family, to my grandchildren, that at the end of the day, if they're permitted and they start to move equipment into our territory, I'll be standing on the line to prevent them from building this project. I'll go to jail if necessary. And I'm not doing it as a protest. I wouldn't do it as a civilly disobedient person. Rather, I do it as a chai is the person obeying our own laws. The Coastal First Nations made a declaration that was signed by all communities, including mine, and they banned very large crude carriers from plying the waters of the North Coast. So that's why I'll do what I have to do if at the end of the day it's permitted. I made this commitment in Prince Rupert at a large gathering of people, and fully half of the crowd that was in attendance stood up and indicated that they'd be there to support me. So I'm pretty confident that the governments don't want to have that type of confrontation. At least I'm hoping not. But it's going to happen if they begin to push this bad project on our community.
I think I heard you say that you would be engaging in civil disobedience if necessary. And I think I heard you said this wasn't a political move. It was something you would do as a Haisla person.
Well, I'm attempting to make this point that, you know, it's not an act of civil disobedience in my mind. It wouldn't be if I'd done what I had to thought I had to do. Rather, it's obeying our community's own laws. And to be really blunt with you and your listeners, our laws were very simple. And one of them was, you don't crap on your own dinner plate. So, you know, this is in effect what we'd be allowing to happen if this big project went ahead. The Gitgat First Nation, all of the coastal nations still rely heavily on seaweed that grows out in the coast, abalone, if we're able to get them to reproduce properly. But clams, cockles, I mean, all of the food stuff that we've relied on for generations are still available to us and still relied on quite heavily. One oil spill is going to take it all away from us. So, you know, it's really an issue of food security for our nations at this point.
In your outreach, you've come to Winnipeg apparently for the first time. Where else has this fight taken you?
It's mainly been limited to our province at the moment. We've done most of our work in getting the communities mobilized and getting the people, the communities having a conversation. 60 communities along the Fraser River is a lot of people to get on the same page at any given time, right? But that's what we've been focusing on. This is really the first time I've ventured this far afield. But in early April, I'm going to be in Cambridge, in England, bringing this message. The British Association of Canadian Studies, I believe it's called, has an annual conference there, and it's funded somewhat by our federal government. And this year, the theme of the conference is Canadian environmental issues. So we're going to take one to them.
Gerald Amos, is there anything else you'd like to share with Winnipeg listeners before we wrap up?
Well, I guess the part of what I've got to say is that, you know, we're all in this together. I mean, I think people know enough these days about the impacts that climate change could have on us if we allow it to continue the way it's going. And as a Chinese businessman said to us last year through an interpreter, the sooner the human family understands that we're all in this together and that we need clean air, we need clean water, and we need happy people, the sooner we're going to start to address the issues that are contributing to climate change.
Gerald Amos, thank you very much for sharing these thoughts with us, and all the best on your trip back.
Thank you.